Okay, welcome everyone to our very special edition of the Football Scholars Forum, our first session of 2020 in very strange and uncertain circumstances, as we are, most of us, I think, stuck at home coping with the pandemic of COVID-19 or coronavirus. Dr. David Kilpatrick and Tom McCabe approached me about having a session to replace the absence of live football on the weekends and said, why don't we have one at the traditional British kickoff time of 3 p.m. on Saturday? And I thought that was a brilliant idea. So they suggested a discussion on the Netflix series, The English Game, which just came out a few days ago. And since we're all home, most of us, and able to watch this, we binged on The English Game. And now we're going to have an interesting discussion about it. Alex Galarza is the other co-coordinator, shall we say, of the Football Scholars Forum. And he's on the line as well from Philadelphia. Usually we do a round of introductions, but we won't do it today because we just have too many folks. And indeed, I would like to turn it over to David and Tom in a moment. But just want to say that I did watch the series, and it was a bit of a struggle, frankly. I thought it was rather dull entertainment, but I am eager to hear from the experts on the subject on what the interpretation of the history was like. And I accounted for the fact that, you know, historical films are not academic monographs. They have different objectives. It's a different medium. But I found the dialogue was quite predictable and quite canned. And the photography was really hard to take, maybe because I watched it in a fairly short amount of time. This endless series of close-ups and quite repetitive scenes, like the establishment shot of the Cotton Masters Club. I must have seen that 13 times. I was starting to dream about it. And a few other things. I was kind of hankering for real politics and for elite debauchery and violence and drunkenness, which we got very little of. There was a complete absence of empire as well, even though India had been the crown jewel of the British Empire for quite some time at this point. And of course, Kumasi had already been looted and sacked and burned, and the Zulu Empire was in fact dismantled in the very year of 1879. But maybe I was asking too much of Julian Fellows. Okay, turn it over to Alex, maybe for a couple of comments, and then our moderators. Thank you.
Just wanted to say it's really good to see everyone. I'm looking forward to a really interesting discussion, but I just wanted to voice again that there's 35 participants in the call, which is more than double what we normally draw for these kinds of events. So please use the chat. Please use the hand raising functions. Please keep your comments brief, which is a lot to ask of a group of colleagues, but everyone's made some time to come together and talk about football, and that's always a beautiful thing. So just asking for respect of that time to keep it brief and try and carry that celebratory spirit into our discussion. Thanks.
Hello, this is Tom McCabe. Thank you to Peter and Alex, the motive forces behind Football Scholars Forum. As Peter mentioned, today's session came out of an email exchange between a number of us at the Society for American Soccer History. Let's binge watch The English Game and then get together to discuss it. So thanks to Peter and Alex and FSF for hosting us, record-setting crowd here. I think I know how today's session is going to go, but let me maybe be the first one to say that it's okay if this was a guilty pleasure for you. But looking forward to examining it in this scholarly forum. Did that just a couple days ago in my Global History of Soccer course at Rutgers Newark. We watched a few episodes. It was actually a student's idea. And then we met for a discussion. So this is the second time I'll be meeting, and it's going to be great to have the experts chime in. So, I mean, obviously The English Game is a story about 1880s football and some transitional and transformational moments. The story of the American game also had some pivotal moments during the same time period. Founded in 1884, the American Football Association became the oldest governing body outside the United Kingdom. The very first meeting took place in a Scottish thread company's firehouse. The spark was lit. The next season, 13 teams competed for the AFA Cup, a knockout competition modeled after the FA Cup. And ONTFC lifted that cup, made by the famed Tiffany & Company, and the winning side was that of the Mill team. So these English and Scottish stories also resonate with us across the Atlantic. And now I'd like to pass it over to David Kilpatrick, the moderator for today's session. One of the features of the series was the influence of the team captain, right? He made all the decisions, he led. So David has done that for us, and hopefully we can lift him up on our shoulders after today's successful 90 minutes. So enjoy, everyone, and thanks for joining in.
Thank you, Tom. I'd like to consider you my co-conspirator in such matters as this. And this really came out of a Society for American Soccer History kind of brainstorm, and I'm glad to see a lot of those SASH members on this call today. And thank you again to Peter and Alex, Football Scholars Forum, as in a short period of time, just a couple of years, become such an important part of our lives as scholars and as friends. So thank you so much for helping provide the forum. Yeah, today's session is really in the spirit of very much filling a void. In a parallel universe, perhaps, my plans were, at this very moment, I should have been at the Crown Ground, or as it's marketed now as the Wham Stadium. I was supposed to be watching Accrington Stanley play Coventry right now. And I should have been probably nursing a night out in Manchester with Kyle Ferguson and Daniel Rijka, who I also believe are both on that call. But instead, I'm up here in the Mohawk Valley in the village of Canajoharie, if anybody's ever heard of that. It's where the paper bag was invented. That's our claim to fame here, the paper bag. So it's really great to reach out and communicate with so many friends and people whose work I admire. In the absence of live football, the English game has in some ways filled a void. I think Tom's already used that term, guilty pleasure. I guess we need to keep in mind that this is not an avant-garde film directed by Buñuel and Dalí. It is what it is. I confess that I enjoyed it immensely. I watched it with my wife, my son, and my daughter. And we got a big kick out of it, pun intended. But it also got me thinking so much about the work of so many people that I admire. And I'm so grateful that so many of them have joined us, agreed to participate in this call. So we've got a lot of experts. We've got nearly 50 people have registered for the call. So many of them could be the experts providing commentary on this, and I do want everybody to get their chance to have a bit of a say. But the guest or featured speakers that we'll have today are Andy Mitchell, Jed O'Brien, Martin Westby, Tony Collins, Gene Williams, and David Mason. So the agenda, if you will be that each one of the guest featured speakers are going to give their thoughts on the English game, hopefully in under 5 minutes each. And then we have a series of pre-submitted questions and comments from Amy Kittelstrom, Daniel Rijka, Ken Tomasz, and Joanna Mellis that I'll try to kind of package along Aristotelian categories. As Tom has alluded to, and Peter's already got his somewhat cynical perspective in on. There's a lot of divided opinion about this. The critics have either loved or loathed it. Nothing seems to be too lukewarm on it. But more on that anon. I'd like to pass it along to our guest or featured speakers first. After, again, they give their opening comments, we'll go to the submitted questions and comments, and then after that, we'll open up the floor to discussion. So if you have a hand raised or a comment or question to make, please do so in the chat function, and Tom McCabe will try to put everything in a proper sequence as that goes. So Andy Mitchell, I'm hoping you're on the call right now.
Yes, I am. I'm here.
The chat function is always a good space. And I agree, Peter, the Romans invented cynicism, and I think they brought it all the way up to the outskirts of Glasgow to old Kilpatrick. But that's a history lesson for another day. So Andy Mitchell is the author of Arthur Kinnaird, First Lord of Football, the biography on the protagonist for the series, The English Game. He's also the co-author of The World's First Football Club with John Hutchinson, which looks at the early Edinburgh game. So I think he is an ideal person to provide the opening remarks. So Andy, if you will, please.
Well, thank you for the introduction, David. It's good to speak to you. I'm joining the conversation from Dunblane in the middle of Scotland. So greetings across the Atlantic. I'll explain, first of all, a little bit about my own involvement in the program, because they took me on as a historical consultant. And if you're wondering why that is, it's because, as you say, I wrote the biography of Arthur Kinnaird about 10 years ago. And coincidentally, I also gave a talk to the BSSH, British Society of Sports Historians, 4 years ago about Fergie Souter and Jimmy Love. So I had a fair in-depth knowledge of the main protagonists in the program. I first knew about the English game over 10 years ago because the idea came from Eddie Charlton, who's one of the backers of this film, of the series. He was also a backer of Gosford Park, which was one of Julian Fellowes' other programs. He's an Old Etonian, and he came up with the idea for the script well over a decade ago. And it's taken this long for the whole project to come to fruition. And in that time, in the last 10 years, I've done my book on Kinnaird, as I say. This is a book by Keith Dewhurst on underdogs, all about the Darwin team and the 1879 matches. There has been a play at the Edinburgh Festival, which toured around UK a couple of years ago. So there's been a lot of interest. And it all comes down to this iconic 5-all draw between Darwin and Old Etonians, which has really captured the public imagination. It's so iconic, even though it's just a draw, that nobody that season really thinks about the fact that Old Etonians won the cup. That's never really mentioned. Or even that in the first round of the FA Cup that season, they knocked out the holders, Wanderers, by a score of 7-2. So this draw is against Darwin is the game that really matters. And that's why it's the focus for this film. I enjoyed the series. I'm fully aware it wasn't historically accurate in many, many respects, not just in the football, but in all sorts of other areas, whether it was the cotton riots, which in fact took place the year before, or the social ethos at the time. But it's drama, it's enjoyable, and like other historical films, it has dramatic license, whether you look at Chariots of Fire, Escape to Victory, The Damned United, and so on. They all play loose with the facts, but they're fundamentally based on factual events. I enjoyed it. I think it's great. I was very happy to be involved. My main involvement was more on the technical details of how football was played at the time, how the officials interacted, the playing conditions. I didn't have any influence on the script, unfortunately, because I could have made quite a lot of changes to that. But that's just my background. I hope everyone else enjoyed it at whatever level, and I look forward to everyone else's comments.
Andy, thank you so much. And again, I just want to really, really strongly recommend anyone that enjoyed the series or maybe didn't. Arthur Kinnaird, First Lord of Football is a fantastic read. So thank you, Andy. Next speaker up, when I first heard that this series was coming out, I immediately thought of the work of Jed O'Brien and thought, oh my God, he's going to have a heart attack over this thing. This is going to be at the expense of the Scotch professors. Jed O'Brien is the author of Played in Glasgow, and he's the chief historian of the Hampden Collection. And if you don't follow his Twitter feed, you really should. He's been giving some fantastic running commentary over the past week on the English game, and just about a daily basis gives us a good dose of Scottish engagement over the origins of the game. So, Jed, take it away.
Thank you, David. So I'll dive straight in. The English game has been a blast of fresh air for one reason. It's the first time I've seen a popular program allude to the fact that it was the Scotch professor who founded modern world football. My take on this mini-series is slightly unusual. Since starting the project in 1990 to build the world's first accredited National Museum of Football, I have laboured pretty much in vain to push the story in the UK. In reality, United Kingdom means England. There is no story of the British game, it is England. Now, I'm generally positive about the English game, because it has mentioned some of the facts known to me for years, but ignored by an English audience. My delight at the initial 30 minutes of the first episode has not been lessened by the narrative veering off in later episodes into hackneyed territory and the intriguingly surreal. The hackneyed is the story being based on Old Etonians and the FA, a football association founded in London that barely controlled its own region, let alone the nation. And what of the surreal? Apparently, there was a team called Blackburn. The Olympic and the Rovers seem to have amalgamated in this alternate history created by Julian Fellowes. But why am I so pleased? Why do I choose to ignore elements of the narrative which are concerning knowledgeable Lancastrian football fans? Well, tactically, in the short term, I'm happy to take some of the crumbs that fall off an English table. I know from personal experience that the London-based media will not countenance the idea that England did not invent football. I give Andrew Watson in evidence. In that first episode, Souter meets Kinnaird. He drops in the little depth charge that he saw Kinnaird play at Hampden a few years previously. I was delighted beyond belief. Why? Because the first Hampden Stadium was mentioned. The world's first purposely built international football ground. Arguably our oldest and most important patch of footballing real estate in the world. Secondly, Souter is getting in a wee dig. He's reminding Kinnaird that the Wanderers, a team containing himself and Charles Alcock, were humbled 5-0 by the Scotch professors of the Queen's Park Football Club in 1875. You know, Queen's Park, the most important club in the history of modern world football. The fact that this subtle observation will be missed by 99% of the viewers is understandable. But as Chairman Mao once said, the long march began with one step. I realise that most of the critiques of the English game are focusing on the class war in English football and the spectre of Northern professionalism. It is an English programme for an English audience with English reviewers. But the fact that Souter and Love are clearly identified as Scots and that they are playing a game which the English do not understand, well, that'll do for me. Donning my English teacher's hat, I feel that Julian Fellowes has done what he does best. He's produced a lavish series interweaving love and loss with the class war in Victorian England. Baron Fellowes of West Stafford is a well-known Tory. However, he's allowed some element of a working class side to the story, even if it is to energise the narrative rather than make a political point. I am just delighted with the appearance of Fergie Souter and Jimmy Love. These two characters have landed in the narrative and become gods from the machine. Superior beings who will alter later critiques of the series as people delve deeper. I have become inured to being told the same nonsense over the years. Football Association, Kinnaird Handstand, Alcock 1872, Wembley Stadium, White Horse Cup Final, Arthur Wharton. when a program takes liberties with what was always a fascinating story, I'm not overly perturbed. Cynically, that fight is not my priority. When the same program puts words into actors' mouths, such as, "Suter, your passing game is the future of football," or Fergie saying, "I'm trying to tell you how we played the game in Scotland," eliciting the dull riposte from a teammate, "But that's not how we play." It's not the best that it could be, but it is a start. Thank you.
Thank you, Jed. Our next guest featured speaker is perhaps then a little bit of an English counterbalance to Jed's Scottishness. I do want to mention en passant, and Andy will confirm this, I'm assuming Jed will too, but in terms of notions of national identity, one thing that's omitted from the series is the fact that Arthur Kinnaird was actually capped once for Scotland. His father was indeed one of the past masters of the Freemasons in Scotland. So Kinnaird had very strong connections to Scotland, and at about that time, half of the FA board identified themselves as Scots. Whether people living in Scotland would agree with them in that identification is another matter. But Martin Westby is the author of England's Oldest Football Clubs, 1815-1889, and A History of Sheffield Football, 1889. His research into these early football clubs is of inestimable value, and he did text me the other day saying, when I gave him a list of the guest speakers, I think at that point you called it 4-1 to Scotland, Martin, but I'm sure your goal will be most memorable. So, Martin, if you will, please take it away.
Thanks very much for that, David. Yes, it does look like the sides are a bit more balanced now. Down in Bournemouth on the south coast of England, but don't judge me too badly on that. I've got 5 minutes on my thoughts on the programme. It's clearly a rating success. It raises awareness of early Victorian football, which ultimately creates a rising tide of interest in all the geographic areas involved in the period, such as Cambridge, Sheffield, Lancashire and Glasgow. The programme is also being subtitled for 6 European countries, and whilst Netflix famously never revealed their viewing figures, surely millions will watch this latest offering from Julian Fellowes. There is some fantastic dialogue when it isn't dealing with football facts. In my opinion, someone has written one of the best descriptions of football ever during an interchange between Fergus Suter and his girlfriend whilst discussing the beauty of football. She says, "It's what music must look like." The recreation of the actual games are fantastic and have not been seriously done since the FA attempted it in the 1972 film Cup Glory. Netflix budget has also extended to recreating the little tin idol, the very first FA Cup, which is used in the climactic scenes of episode 6. Presumably it currently resides on Julian Fellowes' mantelpiece in Dorset, and if it's looking for a suitable home for it, then can I suggest that the newly instigated football archive in Sheffield would love to make it the centrepiece of its new exhibitions. The series has been criticised for playing fast and loose with the football facts, and its supporters have counter-argued that it's just a costume drama and not a factual documentary. But would a historically correct drama documentary achieve the necessary viewing figures? Would it even have been commissioned in the first place? The true facts are certainly casualties in the English game, but I don't think Fellowes and his team of writers were overly preoccupied with historical certitude. They wanted to replicate past successes such as Gosford Park and Downton Abbey, where entitled aristocrats bump up against plucky working class types. Everyone lives happily ever after. The writers needed class conflict and a resounding finale where the plucky underdogs beat the heartless toffs. The solution was to blend Darwin FC with Blackburn Olympic FC into a fictional club, Blackburn FC. This approach of writer's license trumping historical fact has clearly worked in terms of bums on seats, and does it really matter that the truth has been disregarded? In my opinion, I think it does. Peter Morgan's script for Netflix The Crown managed to maintain historical characters and a series of real events whilst weaving a fictitious dialogue around them, why couldn't the same have been done for the English game? To maintain the necessary drama, a much better candidate for the main role in the series would have been Jack Hunter from Sheffield, who only appears in a short cameo performance in the series. He was a working man who played for Healy FC. He clashed with the Sheffield FA over appearance money when he turned out for the Zulus. In response, he crossed the Pennines to be a paid player coach of Blackburn Olympic FC. Short-lived team achieved the most seismic moment in FA Cup history by being the first Northern team to overturn the 11-year monopoly of Old Boys Southern teams and win the FA Cup. In 1888, McGregor chose Blackburn Rovers over Blackburn Olympic to play in the newly constituted Football League. This marked the end of Olympic, and Hunter became assistant coach and groundsman at Blackburn Rovers. What a story. Football history should aim to be factual because myths damage the game. In my book, I question a lot of long-standing football facts and I dispel a number of creation myths surrounding early football clubs that have been repeated over and over for many years. After watching this series, millions of people Europe-wide will think that Fergus Souttar winning the FA Cup for Blackburn FC in 1880 is a fact. In truth, the first FA Cup finally played in for Blackburn Rovers was in 1882 against the Old Etonians, and they lost. Although I enjoyed watching the blurring of fact and fiction in the English game, I completely expected that at the end of episode 6, the final credits would explain the actual events and outcomes and the true biographies of the players involved. This way, the viewers would have known they'd been watching a piece of fiction and it could have been the perfect end. They weren't, and I think it's an opportunity missed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin. One of the many sins of omission is notion of Kinnaird and his comrades being in absolute control of the association code, when in fact in these early days there was a lot of confusion among codes. Things were not all settled in October 1863 at the Freemasons Tavern. But Arthur Kinnaird and his Old Etonians were quite good natured in that when they would offer to compete with others, they would be willing to play in whatever code their opposition preferred. And that's a point that Tony Collins makes very well in my favorite book of 2019. I hope no one is offended by that on this call. How Football Began on Routledge, that, as I say, my favorite book of 2019, where he makes that strong case that many footballers in this era were willing to play any code, whether it be under Sheffield rules, the association code, rugby rules, what have you. How Football Began is an incredibly important book, as is Sport and Capitalist Society. So Professor Emeritus of History from De Montfort University, Tony Collins.
Thanks, David. I feel very flattered by your comments. I think this is a really interesting discussion, one that's worth having. Just to kind of elaborate on the point that you were just making about the way that the games of rugby and football, as we would know them today, were not divided in the same way that we understand them today. I think it's the case that, to give a bit of background, when the English game took place, the 1878 to 1880 period was a key inflection point in how soccer became more popular than rugby. Because throughout the 1870s, rugby was the more popular game in terms of clubs and crowds, but the two sports had not fully separated and there was a lot of crossover between them. So, for example, Darwin's first match in the FA Cup in 1877 was against Manchester Rugby Club, who were trying their hand at soccer. Preston North End and Burnley, two massive clubs in the future for football, were actually rugby clubs at this time. And the 1880 winners of the FA Cup, Clapham Rovers, also played rugby and were one of the founder members of the rugby union. So in a sense, contrary to the way that it's presented in the series, football did not occupy the absolutely central role in sporting culture at that time as it does today, which I think is a good lesson in understanding the history of football and the other codes that are derived from football did not take a linear path. Because I guess most importantly, if we're looking at the linear path and paths not taken, in 1878, the rugby union made the decision not to start a national knockout cup competition along the lines of the FA Cup. And this was a real sliding doors moment because it gave the Football Association an open goal for the FA Cup to become the most important trophy in any type of football and become an arena where local, regional, class rivalries, as we can see in the film, could be expressed through soccer, association football. I'm going to be slightly more critical, I think, than the other speakers. The main issue I have with the series is the fact that it really portrays an anachronism in that the characters in a series set 140 years ago talk about football in the same way as we speak about it today. There's lots of dialogue about the glory of the cup, the prestige of the FA Cup, and the good of the game, and so on. And in the last episode, Arthur Kinnaird even talks about spreading football to Africa, just at the time when British imperialism was carving up the continent. I don't think that's really how people would speak about football at that time. Football culture as we know it today had barely been born, if at all. And people like Arthur Kinnaird saw the game as an extension of muscular Christianity rather than a thing in itself. And I think the other issue is that the series gives no sense of how incredibly quickly the sporting world was changing. 10 years before the action in the English game, there was no FA Cup, and the idea of thousands of people paying to watch a football match would have been unthinkable. And it was only in 1874 that most working class people even had Saturday afternoon free to play football. So there was a genuine shock of the new period going on at this stage that no one had experienced before. And I think that's not really captured by the show. And as people have said, it's not fair to pick it up on factual data because that's not what drama's about. But nevertheless, I think some of the way in which it's presented is looking through the spectacles of the present at the past. Because if you look at the Darwin versus Orbitonians match from a social history perspective, it's quite possibly the first time in British history, in any walk of life, that a group of working class people had met a group from the English upper classes on anything like equal terms. But because the series portrays the past through the lens of how we think about football today, the characters have no sense of amazement or novelty about what is happening to them or in society. In a sense, I think the series portrays football as it will become in the 20th century, but not how it was then. I just end on two quick ultra-critical points. The first one, I think Andy will probably disagree with me here, is that I think the portrait of Kinnaird is too flattering. Because in real life, he was a prominent supporter of groups like the National Vigilance Society, which campaigned against so-called immorality, and in 1889 was behind the jailing of an English publisher for publishing obscene books like Flaubert's Madame Bovary. And Kinnaird also supported the jailing of Oscar Wilde for being gay in 1895 and went on to call for further repression against gay men. I think the other point overall about the series is that, to my eyes, it presents a very patronising picture of working class people. We're constantly told that football is the only thing they have in their lives. But this is a caricature that ignores the rich culture of industrial working class life, such as the cooperative society, miners' institutes, trade unions, brass bands, political organisations. Sport was an essential part of that culture, but it was definitely not the only part, and certainly not the dominant part. So I think even if the English game does do a good job of getting us talking about an absolutely fascinating and pivotal period in the crucial early years of modern football, it should not blind us to the fact that it offers quite a reactionary view of society as a whole at that time.
Tony, thank you very much. Again, as I think everybody's picked up here, a lot of the criticism of the miniseries has been along the lines of historical accuracy. And we're blessed with a number of historians as our guests or featured speakers. So we're going to emphasize that very much. My own background, I have feet in a few different camps. My doctorate is in comparative literature, but I have master's in philosophy and sport management and a dual appointment in English literature and sport management at Mercy College in New York. So to kind of fill in a little bit of that balance in some ways, I think our next speaker has a likewise kind of a dual disciplinary background. Jean Williams is professor of sport at University of Wolverhampton. Her doctorate was on the revival of women's football and English culture 1960 to 2000 at De Montfort University. But she also has a Master of Arts in Modern Literature from Leicester University. And I should note, we are tweeting using the hashtag FSF English Game. But Jean Williams's tweets are a little more special than all the rest of us because hers are archived by the British Library. I'm very happy to welcome Jean. Thank you.
Thank you, David. As you indicate, my remarks are going to be in relation to the form of this series. And I just want to center my comments really around three areas that I think we've all highlighted. One is authenticity. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. What are the aims of the series? Because actually we've got to think about this not as a film, although it's obviously very well resourced and filmic in its aspirations. I don't think it's necessarily best thought of as a film. It's probably best thought of, as one critic over here put it, as Downton Abbey for boys. So the form that we're actually talking about, we're talking about a TV series that we're actually discussing rather seriously. And then what is its context? And the comments that I want to make around that are that I think it's evidence of the new nostalgia. I think it was Andy who mentioned Chariots of Fire. And it seems to me that this is a film that the series aspires to be. So just taking each of those points separately, in terms of authenticity, the overall narrative arc of the series is that, you know, the upper classes more or less invent football and the working classes are usurpers. And we know from, you know, the work of Peter Swain, Graham Curry and others, that actually there were lots of collective gains that people did, that the working class did, that gave them a kind of ownership of football and indeed rugby, as Tony Collins has highlighted. Those kind of collective gains were born out of a broader collective culture. And so I thought the narrative arc of the series was a little bit oversimplistic. For me, its biggest downfall was that there was just not enough football. And we know that football is very, and sport generally, is very difficult to recreate on film, with numerous examples that everybody here could mention. I'm the football person in my house. I watched it with my husband, Simon, who's the petrol head. And he, after, you know, three episodes, turned to me and said, well, there's just not enough football. And certainly if you're a football fan, there isn't enough football. There's too much romance. You know, that again, within that overall narrative arc, the paradigm that women are concerned with their fertility and men are concerned with their virility is very much reinforced. So it's very simplistic in that way. And so what kinds of authenticity are at play here? On the point of what are the aims of it, well, mainly it's to be entertaining, isn't it? It has a nod to historical accuracy, but mainly it's a form of entertainment, hence the obsession with the kind of love interest, which, again, are pretty tedious and lead to some pretty clunky dialogue. And then what is its context? So just to finish, to say that actually I think it aspires to be Chariots of Fire, which the context of that film, which came out in 1981, as most people will know, in Thatcherite Britain, at the time when Thatcher had tried to get Britain to stay out of the 1980 Olympic Games. And it was very much a nostalgia for the amateur ideals and shouldn't sport be purer. And I think it's quite interesting that this series comes out at a time in a hiatus of sport where people are latching onto that new nostalgia. Could we perhaps reinvent sport when this hiatus is over as something more pure? And I've read a number of articles by a number of high profile, both academics and columnists, saying, you know, should we reinvent sport as something more pure? And this seems to me to be evidence of a new broader nostalgia that, that Fellows is riding the wave of, because actually sport, as the series points out, is very much invested within capitalism and different forms of capitalism and competing forms of capitalism. So as evidence of that new nostalgia, I think it's perhaps looking towards a somehow idealized past. And so I would, if I was teaching this series, I think I would teach it alongside Chariots of Fire and juxtapose those two. Thank you.
Thank you, Jean. I must say, in 2012, when I was approached to be the club historian for the New York Cosmos, there was an understanding at the club that a custodian was needed to carry on the legacy of North America's most successful soccer club. But the very paradigm of how to handle such a role it was to be found in the world's most successful football club, Rangers Football Club of Glasgow. And I'm very, very pleased to have David Mason join us, who in his role as club historian for Rangers is the author of several books, including Rangers the Managers, Rangers a Match to Remember, and one of my very personal favorites. He's the co-author of Mr. Struth the Boss. So David, thank you for joining us, and your turn.
Thanks, David. Yeah, it's a pleasure to join such esteemed company today. I'm in Glasgow at the moment. I'm two miles away from the site of the first international, Scotland v England, and only 2 miles away from where our club was formed as well, in the east end of Glasgow. So I'm right at the heart of it, although obviously the programme portrays the FA, and quite rightly so, in terms of its origins in London. But as far as Rangers are concerned, established in early 1872, and I've been at the club for so long that I feel as if I was there at its origins. At least my wife tells me I look that way anyway. I think we shouldn't look too much into this programme. I think it's good to take what we can from it. But we have to remember it's a drama and it's not a documentary. I enjoyed the programme, not least because one of the key characters, of course, Fergie Souttar, came from our city in Glasgow. Apparently, he wasn't good enough to play for us. I think the programme probably gave a fair characterisation of the different styles of football at the time. You know, someone else mentioned about the professors and the passing game that we, well, we didn't adopt, we invented as such, as opposed to what the English game was doing at the time. And their characterisation of hacking. Now, I know that was forbidden by the rules of the FA ultimately, but it was still quite evident in the programme, I think, in the way that the old Etonians seemed to be approaching the matches against Darwin. The story was dramatised, of course, and there's a little substance to suggest that Fergus's life was anything like that shown in the programme. Some people might say he portrayed a typical Scots character, but I've not had a drink since last night, so I don't think that was fair. So I think it shouldn't be taken too literally. In essence, the key point for the historians is it gave, in my opinion, a reasonable perspective of the early conflicts between the upper class gentlemen or the public school types of that period and the average man in the street. And in fact, I saw quite an interesting comment from Charles Clegg, who played for England in the first international in 1872. He played with Sheffield. He was only Northern on the team at that time. And after the match, he said that he didn't enjoy it too much because the snobs from the South had no use for a lawyer from Sheffield. So it gives some indication of the stresses that existed in the game at that time. Perhaps, rather than working class striving to make an impact in the game, as displayed in the programme, they'd already done that much before Souttar's time. In fact, Glasgow Rangers, for example, Queen's Park, as we know as well, had made quite great strides in the game, well, at least 10 years before the period shown in the programme. And I think also as far as the popularity is concerned, I think one of the things I did like about it was it did highlight the importance it had to communities and the growing attendances that were already starting to surround the game. I like some of the detail in the programme, like the style of the Etonians. In their original rules, they formed almost like a scrum, a bank of eight players who would gather around the ball and kick it forward from there. And I think they did try and display that, and it's a credit to Andy Mitchell and getting some of these aspects of the detail through into the programme. I think it also highlighted the spread of professionalism, which was carried out under the table effectively, although that was a problem that had started long before the period shown in the programme. But it was a particular issue to Scotland. Many of our players were lost to the south, and in fact, our team set up a vigilante committee to send some agents south of the border with more than a fleeing area. At the time, we lost a lot of players during that period, so I think it did characterise that. Even one of our founders was lured to Blackburn around the time that Fergie Souttar was there. I thought the playing kit looked authentic, although Arthur wasn't wearing the blue and white quartered cap he usually wore. He seemed to have dyed his red beard too. So all in all, I thought it as a drama, it was good. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the filming of it. Unlike Peter, I thought it was pretty well done. I thought it gave a reasonable perspective on how football was at that time. All in all, I thought it was basically a good story, and we probably shouldn't look into it as much more than that.
Very good. Thank you very much, David. Yeah, we did get the handstand, but we didn't get the famous blue and white cap. And I would also add that while the beard was not red, the actor was much too tall. It's unfortunate they couldn't have found someone who was 5'6". So that brings to a conclusion our opening half. Thank you to all the guest featured speakers for staying within the allotted time. Greatly appreciated, and that gives us plenty of time, I hope, for the comments and questions that have been pre-submitted, and as well any other comments or questions that other participants may have. Now, I must confess that my co-conspirator, Tom McCabe, probably heard me talk way too much about Aristotle in the past week. I also think Peter and Alex didn't really care to hear too much about it. Fortunately for them, I wasn't going off about the Nicomachean Ethics this week, though I've been thinking about it a lot. I've been talking a lot about poetics and the constituent elements that Aristotle comes up with there. Plot, characterization, theme, language, sound, and spectacle. And interestingly enough, the questions and comments that came in fit very well into five of those six categories. So some of the submissions, I'll kind of split them up, but I'm going to go in Aristotle's preferred sequence with this. And I'll open up with a question from Daniel Rika. Daniel, are you there? From the American
Yes, University. I am, yeah.
Again, we should have been in Manchester this week, but yes. It's great to connect here. Your question was, I would be interested to learn from football historians how historically accurate the series is. This has been addressed somewhat in the speaker's comments, but do you want to just kind of add anything to that question and then open it up to our speakers?
No, a lot was said already in the tweets prior to the recording that there were not, in reality, there were three matches between the Old Etonians against Darwin and that not two like in the series, and other facts like with the cotton riots that took place a year before and so on. And somebody, I think, said very well, it's a drama, not a documentary. I think that was an important sentence. I was just thinking, I found very interesting what Tony Collins said, that like a lot of what characterized working class life was not covered, like how they were organized in unions, etc. So the more I hear, the more I'm thinking, why is it just a mini series? why is it just 6 episodes? Maybe it should have been 10 or 12 episodes, which would have had also the advantage of our pleasing our miserable life without live football at the moment more. But then more of these topics maybe could have been elaborated better.
Thank you, Daniel. Do any speakers want to address anything raised by Daniel just now?
If I may, David, I'll put myself in here. I'm going to take a slightly different view. Hopefully people appreciate that I've been ploughing a furrow about pushing Scotland as the real inventors of the game. And cynically, I like the fact that Fellows is happy to say that he knows nothing about football. Because, yes, you could have done a much, much more interesting program based around Preston North End being thrown out of the FA Cup, the suggestions of a British Football Association. It's always intrigued me how people who write scripts take a story which on its own is unbelievably interesting and then decide they've got to change it to make it better. So I'm happy in that, to me, because he knew nothing about football, he allowed the characters to make mention of the fact that Suter and Love were playing a kind of football which was beyond the ken of the Darwin players. And I think, God, if you actually were really into football, you might have decided not to go down that road, because I'm delighted, because those few bits of football accuracy for me, I think, have opened up a scene which I'm going to mine in the next 10 years. Yet, it would have been really nice to have it explained that there was an Olympic and there was a Rovers, and their stories are superb on their own, but he didn't do it. But in a sense, I thank him for that, because he did what he needed to do for Fergie Suter in the first 20 minutes.
Thank you for that. Yeah, one thing that I think should be mentioned is that a play was out at the Edinburgh Fringe called The Giant Killers. Andy, I think you may have seen it, but there was a stage version of this for 4 actors, 3 male, 1 female character, that I believe will be revived again this summer if theaters are opened again. Anyone, Andy, or anyone else on this call catch that play?
Yeah. Can I just make a comment on the series? I found the series interesting. But, and I note that Andy suggested that they might well go on and do another one. I think that possibly a more interesting period would be the 10 years before that, you know, from 1870, in fact, going right up to 1880, when in fact the game was effectively being born. You know, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that football was quite common, even back as far as the 1850s. Lots of different rules, but many communities would play football, play with a ball as such. You know, the first balls were actually made as such in 1866. Lily White was making a 3, 4, a 5 and size 6 ball. So the game of football was around in various forms, and I think it'd been good to focus in that period when the rules were being evolved and when there was that real strife between the public schools and the working class communities, the working class teams, the northern teams to make their play. So by the time the English game comes on, much of the battle has been won in terms of the establishment of the game.
The American in me wants to point out too that the Lily White's ball was based upon Goodyear's ball that he had at the Paris exhibition. And Charles Goodyear had that football on sale at his brother-in-law's shop in Manhattan in the 1850s. So I would argue the first modern ball in that it had a vulcanized rubber bladder was actually on sale in New York City before it was anywhere else in the world. But yeah, it'd be nice to see the English game before this and after this. James, is there anything you want to add about that?
Yes, hi. Thanks a lot, David. Yeah, I've been in touch with people at the FIFA Museum and just talking about the next, based on the popularity of this series, which I think, given this crisis, has gained a lot of popularity, regardless of negative, comments. The thought is to hop over the pond and dig into the delve into the American game, because there's such a strong connection between the 1920s, building up to the 1930 World Cup, and with immigration, and there's also the textile industry, the steel industry. So there's all these class struggles, and that's currently what's being thought about as spin-offs, and then heading down to South America with Uruguay and Argentina, and then back up to Brazil and popping over to Italy for the 34 World Cup.
Thanks, James.
David, this is Tom. Let me just jump in there. Obviously, I was aware of what James just said from previous conversations, and in that last episode when Arthur makes that kind of "don't you see the future" speech, you know, he says football will spread through the empire and beyond. It's bound to Europe, to Africa, to the United States, to South America. I was thinking of, you know, James' prior knowledge of spreading the series and spreading the game, and there it is, right? That's the invitation to then do a second series or a third series and move it around the globe.
Great stuff. Sorry, I was just having a little trouble clicking back and forth between mute and chat. Some good comments in the chat about the issue of the ball. As David Mason points out, I've been very blessed to see this at the Stirling Museum. The oldest ball in history, believed to have belonged to Mary Queen of Scots, is there in Stirling. And as Jed O'Brien points out, in 1575, Glasgow magistrates commissioned a ball for 2p. The town council regularly ponied up the cash for balls. And if you want a description of how balls were prepared for play, in Hutchinson and Andy Mitchell's book, 1824, The World's First Football Club, if you can imagine someone having the job of inflating the pig bladder, that may have been a lucrative position for some, but it must not have been all that pleasant. So it's neat to be thinking about the ball itself. And we'll have another question coming up on that a little bit later from Ken Tomash. But I do want to point out that Ken had made a comment he sent to me with clippings from the three matches between Darwin and Old Etonians. And I believe he's posted those on Twitter using that hashtag FSF English game. I will get to a question from Tom, but keeping along Aristotle's sequence, the next question will be from Amy Kittlestrom. Amy, are you on the call?
Audio. Hello.
Hello. I'm kind of breaking your comments last question into three parts here. So in terms of characterization, I'll read what you wrote and then see if you have anything else to add on this. Quoting Amy here, quote, "Finally, I watched the series with my daughter, who is 13 years old, and who posed the question of whether it would pass the Bechdel test. It did, but the depiction of the sexual relationship between Suter's girl and her former employer is the most preposterous of them all. They fell in love, really. Aristocrats preyed upon servant girls who sometimes got pregnant, but her projection of independence and clear-eyed choosing is ignorant of history." That opens up to the question of characterization and depth thereof, or lack thereof. Anything you want to add to that question?
Sure, I could just expand a little bit, because it was such an interesting way they dealt with the problem of gender, which is, as I think Jean said earlier, basically just to make women obsessed with reproducing and romance, right? And having nothing to do with the world of football. Even though you see a couple women maybe as spectators, or they care about the outcome, right? And as Afore said, the girlfriend has this understanding of the game as being like music. Especially in light of the fact that the so-called Me Too movement has only just now finally brought the issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault and issues of consent into public consciousness, right? So centuries of, it was only feminist scholars talking about these things, right? In the 19th century, there really was not a concept of females, young single females, having the right to consent. And in the class structure, you know, the upper class, such as the father of her child, viewed working women as entitlements, right? And so the idea that, oh, she fell in love with somebody across class lines and just wished that he would tell his wife about her is late 20th century morality, not even into the 21st century, right? So in so many different places, we have this projection of 21st century values back into dialogue that's completely unrealistic. One of the characters speaks of the daily grind, right? This phrase did not exist, you know, in the 19th century. Similarly, we have a character who's appealing to the wives who are watching it, wives and girlfriends who are watching it, right? With their soccer-loving males. I mean, this is the idea of the audience. And giving that female audience some gratification through a plucky young woman who doesn't take the money, right? She's poor, but she doesn't take the money for their child. It was really preposterous to me.
Thank you very much. Aristotle's categories kind of bleed one into the other. So we kind of start off with muthos or plot, ethos or characterization, and then kind of bleeding out of ethos or characterization into dianoia or theme. With the last question / comment. Joanna Mellis? Joanna, are you on the call?
Yeah, I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi. What you sent was kind of a pedagogical question. And I'll quote this here and see what you have to add to it. What do football scholars think about assigning an episode or two in a sport history class? And so they have an episode that they think does this the best. I have a world history of sport course coming up in the fall, and I'm trying to get students to learn about the non-American sport context. I think the portrayal of class issues and the amateurism-professionalism debate would be helpful for students, especially when making comparisons with the racist implications of the NCAA's continued use of amateurism today. Anything else to add to that?
I guess, yeah. So I guess the only thing I would say is that, one, I'm only through episode 3, so I haven't finished the series, so there may be later episodes that do this well. But yeah, like I said, I guess I'm just looking for a suggestion of like one episode or maybe even a clip in particular that people think really represents the like amateur professionalism debate, since we're going to be like in the class, we're going to be exploring it in different contexts. And like I said, I'm hoping to encourage them to kind of compare across national context, but also like class, racial, gendered lines and things like that. So I'm curious what people would suggest for how to do that.
Well, as it just so happens, while we're becoming experts in distance learning very quickly, Tom McCabe is teaching a global history of soccer course right now at Rutgers Newark, and did this very activity. Tom, do you want to address Joanna's question?
Sure. It's completely a global history of soccer. So we're devoting all the time to soccer and then maybe traveling to other sports occasionally. So we watched episodes 1 and 2 and had a hour plus conversation on Thursday. It went so well and the students were very much into it that we agreed as a group to binge watch the rest of it and continue the conversation on Tuesday. The themes that routinely came up, you know, were gender, just mentioned, you know, class and the intra-class, you know, conflict, as well as, you know, the upstairs, downstairs depiction. So it really, really worked well, especially in this kind of new learning environment that we're in. And the students enthusiastically, you know, said, let's Netflix and learn, you know, over the course of the weekend and in into Tuesday. If I could recommend, I was looking through my notes, what episodes, certainly one of the first two, and then kind of getting to the conclusion, because I think the class depiction is one of the issues that resonates most with students. I'll stop there, and hopefully some other people might have some opinions.
Anyone else? Any thoughts on pedagogy in the series?
Yes. Yes. Obviously, I was delighted by the first program, if only for the fact that I'm concentrating on the Scotch professor and why they barely get mentioned. In fact, it was my only disappointment. I hoped at one stage, and maybe someone will tell me I've missed it, I hope somebody was going to say in the episodes, you're a Scotch professor, Fergie, but they didn't. But hey, Rome wasn't built in a day. The upcoming episodes that the contributor hasn't watched, I think it has some nice, clever, knowing set pieces. I'd love to meet Julian Fellows and go, were you deliberately being sleeker, a good Scottish term, where they're putting things up like it's our game, and they're having arguments between people like Littleton and Kinnaird as to the fact that the game is getting away from them. And I guess either a media course, a sports course could pick apart the words that are put into people's mouths to see what they're actually saying, because it's almost, I watched some of it and almost felt sorry for the old Etonians, because they were given words to say which you knew these words were their obituary, because they were just about, with professionalism, to lose the dominance of the playing game whilst holding on to trying to control the administration of the game. So there's a lot to pick up. For me, the first 10 minutes literally had me screaming at the television in delight, just purely, I never thought I'd see an acceptance that the Scotch professor had brought down a type of football which was unknown to the players. And I would recommend that the students watch stuff like that.
Very good. Thank you. Again, it's interesting how Aristotle's categories sometimes bleed one into the other. So muthos, ethos, theanoia, the fourth category is lexis or language. One of the activities I give my sport and society class, which I teach every spring, is to try to apply Aristotle's poetics to the gridiron American Super Bowl. And the one real big stumbling block is the category of lexis or language. When I did this kind of methodology in an article that was eventually published in Athlon, and I'd given this at the International Association for Philosophy of Sport in Rome a few years back, I applied Aristotle's poetics to the FIFA World Cup final between Spain and the Netherlands. And the toughest of the categories was lexis or language. In that piece, I argue that tactics would be how we would apply that category, the clunkiest of the six really to sport. But clearly with the English game, a lot of the criticism is over some of the dialogue. Again, there's some really great juicy lines, but there's also some kind of close your eyes ones, as Peter had noted when he first opened up. And part of Amy's comments were along language. So again, quoting Amy Kittlestrom here, quote, would it indeed have been possible for any Brit, highborn or otherwise, to make such a speech as Kinnaird did in 1879, foretelling the future of association football around the globe, invoking empire. Among a multitude of other anachronistic deployments of the English language, this struck me as the most far-fetched and the most pernicious in terms of the propaganda the series seeks to impress on the viewer. Football leads the classes to see each other's points of views, the genders to discuss deep emotional matters productively, the male generations to make amends, and everyone else but the drunk to rectify their characters. Does anyone think that this is what really happened when the Scots introduced passing as a strategy? Amy, I just want to confess that I jumped up in my living room and screamed, "See, football saves the world," and my kids and wife bashed me appropriately. Again, quoting Amy, one other note on strategy. It was charming to see the game looking so appropriately close to rugby when they played, but it was absolutely wrong for our hero to speak of space, to say pass and move, and a zillion other things I say to the girls I coach today. So, Amy, anything else on language or anyone else in terms of the dialogue or any of the use of language in the series?
Yeah, if I can just say quickly, I think Tony said some of the things that I meant with that, like, oh, that speech was out of place. But what this seems to land right on, where is history? Where is storytelling? Where is cinema? Where is profit? Like, it's fine for him to have delivered that speech in order to forecast the series that they wanted to continue, right? From the level of TV making. But it was just interesting how then football saves the world. That's actually like my working title for something that I'd like to write, something like that. Because does it or doesn't it? Because profit, right? And so I was just curious what everybody's thoughts were about that intersection of history, cinema, storytelling, all the things that are happening through that role of football.
Can I just come in here? Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point because this is what I was trying to get at one in my the opening remarks. Yeah, I think it's highly improbable, if not impossible, that anybody could make a speech about football traveling around the world at that time, because in the 1870s, and certainly for people like Kinnaird and the people who ran the Football Association, football was seen as having a moral purpose. It was a form of British nationalism. And they weren't very interested in other people playing the game. And the fruits of that, I think you can see by the fact that football did not actually become the sport of the British Empire. Rugby football became the sport of the British Empire, and certainly in the so-called White Dominions. And it was, although there were, in many countries, the people who first started playing the game outside of Britain were British expatriates. By and large, the game was not popularised by the British in other countries. It was popularised by the emerging middle classes in Europe and Latin America. So the idea that Kinnaird or anybody else would think this is going to, football is going to save the world, would be completely alien to them. And I think it's an example of the ahistorical nature of the way that the programme, the series has been written, that it's written with hindsight at best, and at worst it's really putting the words of the 21st century into the mouths of 19th century characters.
Go, please. Oh, okay. Well, one thing I would never have confessed to my comparative literature dissertation committee was my love for telenovela or soap operas. I think in terms of dramatic genre, I think it's fair to say this is a very melodramatic series. And that should bring us in some way to Aristotle's fifth category, melos, or sound. Interestingly enough, there have been no questions or comments about the use of music or song. Does anyone want to address that? I know I'm not sure if we'd begun the conversation yet when there was the discussion of the Old Etonians and their songs, but anybody have any comments about the use of music? And again, with melodrama, it's the use of music in a very subtle way to manipulate our emotions. Anybody have any thoughts on the use of sound in the series?
I suppose, David, if I may, it's Jean. I suppose it's one of the things that made me think of this being a series that aspired to be Chariots of Fire. And also, to some extent, there is a similar use of music compared with the TV series Brideshead Revisited, although I don't think that this has anything of the kind of sophistication of that particular series. So, you know, the use of particularly kind of minor chords in and this combined with the use of light in the way in which the you know, the private large private homes are looked to be bathed in glowing afternoon sunlight adds to this kind of nostalgia effect. And I think the use of the minor chord throughout in the background music, again, is doing some of that. It's looking at, it is a melodrama. It's around what it's around a point of disruption, and there are constant points of disruption. And I think just going back to some of the comments that have been made in the discussion, I think women are the disruptors in this. They're disruptors of friendship. They're disruptors of, men who want to concentrate on football, and yet, they may have to become fathers and think about more serious things. So I think the music adds to this kind of nostalgia effect. The songs, I think, particularly, again, are looking forward to collective football culture and those sorts of chants that we know are coming, but that they can't have known were coming.
Yeah, I think at least we were spared the notion of supporters singing that Old Etonians are by far the greatest team the world has ever seen, or any such mass singing. But that brings us then to Aristotle's last category, the one he is most dismissive of, but perhaps the one that brought all of us to watch this: opsis, or spectacle, the opportunity to see how they might try to stage the playing of 19th century football. And Ken Tomash has a comment or question about that. And Ken, are you there? If Ken is not on the call, I think you are on the call, but you're still muted, Ken. I'm going to go ahead and read your question, and hopefully you can unmute while I quote you. Quote, I guess my actual question would be, at what point did equipment start to get better? I was aghast at what the sides were wearing, both on their feet and elsewhere, not to mention the fact they turn up within minutes of the opening whistle and just start running and kicking. When did boots go from actual boots to something you could maybe get a touch with? And when did uniforms go from matching team shirts with whatever else you happen to have on to starting to resemble anything we might recognize? End quote. Ken, I see you're still muted. I don't know if you want to unmute and say anything. You say you're unmuted in the comments, but it still looks like you are muted, Ken. David Mason addressed this earlier. In terms of historical accuracy of uniforms. Does anyone want to address this question of the spectacle that the miniseries stages for us?
I can pick that up if you want, David. Having spent quite a lot of time at the British Library looking at the history of football boots, one of the really fascinating things about this period is that there are just loads and loads. If you go and sit in the patents section, there are loads and loads of patents applied for during this period, both for starting to develop specific kinds of footwear, but also for modifying existing footwear. So we have to think in this period, actually it's one of the things I thought was quite good about the series, is that we have to think in this period that a working man's boots would have been his most expensive form of clothing, probably. And he would probably have only had one pair of boots. The notion that people would be able to afford to buy specific football boots wasn't always borne out, and this led to a degree of modification and things that you could buy to modify your existing kind of working boots. working men would have had to look after their boots incredibly carefully because they were so expensive. And probably within the family, a working man's boots would have been prioritised within the family economy for them to be provided for, because obviously they, you know, it's so important that people could get out to work. Therefore, the light clothing and the notion that the Etonians can wear lighter clothing, specially dyed clothing, is to some extent authentic, because that they would have been the more expensive colours, and just the notion that you could change into a football strip, again, really gives a sense of entitlement. If you look at the jerseys that England wore in 1872 and that some of the clubs were wearing at that time, the Etonians' clothing does look to be pretty good. So I would say that there was quite a lot of research and advice on that, because that does seem to be pretty authentic.
Can I come in here? I've just been looking at the rules of the Scottish FA in 1873. The final rule number nine, is that each club shall forward its name and name and address to the secretary, and a statement of its distinguishing colours or costume to the secretary of the association. And also in 1872, there was a change of rules in the FA. And the final rule 12, related to studs. So obviously at that time, there was a clear expectation that players would be wearing boots as such, and that related to the type of studs that they wore, or the nails or whatever at the base of their boots. So clearly in 1872, colours were well known amongst the teams. In fact, our club was noted to have royal blue, and our club didn't come from public school background, probably upper, lower class, if you want to call it that, from our guys. Most of them were only 15, 16, 17 years of age. So certainly uniforms and boots were well established way, way, way before the period of the program.
Yeah, that's one aspect of the miniseries I really enjoyed too, the idea of the kit maker and that business. And also, of course, this is something Tom McCabe and I talk about a lot, the thread that binds the game across the Atlantic with the textile industry. Tom, did you want to mention anything about that?
No, I would just echo, you know, those comments, you know, very much the cross-Atlantic textile world and the role of cotton in the very beginnings of the game, the clubs and the technology. For sure. And if I can pivot, Kevin Talek Marston has a question, I believe, directed towards Andy Mitchell on kind of the intra-class conflict. When I spoke with my students the other day, we talked about Arthur Kennard as possibly a class traitor. So Kevin can follow up, and if not, Andy can address that if he's still on the call.
Thanks, Tom. I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
Yep, all good? Okay. Thank you. Andy, if you're still there, I would be very curious to know more about the editorial choices that you were obviously involved in with respect to the characterization of people like Kinnard and Mendoran, and because they paint this wonderful picture of the hero on one side and the nemesis on the other, the bad guy who is still protecting the old order, and Kinnard who is, you know, this future looking forward looking gentleman hero. So I'd be curious from your perspective, working on, you know, obviously you've worked on Kinnard's life and everything, but how were those decisions made from an editorial view with the producers of the series? And I would just like to pick a little bit apart, if you provide some background to, you know, how you had to let go of maybe some historical things fight them on certain things and you know why certain choices were made, maybe specific to that interclass conflict, if that's something you could expand on. Thank you.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. If have I got the microphone?
Yes, please.
Good. Kevin, when you joined the conversation, I'd already said a little bit about the fact that I didn't have much influence on the script itself, but I did have a few arguments along the way about how they characterized Arthur Kinnaird, what kind of person he would be. The one argument I particularly remember was that they wanted him to do his famous handstand after every single goal that he scored. And I said that just wouldn't be realistic. It looked like he was ramming it down people's throats, that he could score, he could be better than them. And he only did it once, and that was after his final FA Cup win in 1882. So they managed to just incorporate it once in the series, so that it didn't become a defining feature of him and show him to be a pompous ass. Apart from that, it was very difficult to have much influence because the script had already been written when I saw it. And a lot of the comments I made were perhaps brushed aside because they were not seen as particularly relevant to the way the series was being portrayed. My much stronger influence was in the portrayal of the football matches itself, showing how people would behave at matches, what kind of tactics they would use. So I'm afraid I didn't have a huge amount of influence over the portrayal of the characters themselves. And in some respects, it would have been very difficult to, because they were not shown in their true light. I mean, silly things like Kinnaird's wife desperate for a baby, whereas in fact, they already had a daughter by this time. They did have a stillborn child later on, but that was a different perspective. What was if she was still dreaming of having a son at that point, or some kind of child? So there's lots of things that were difficult to influence, and I'm afraid I didn't have a huge amount of influence.
Thank you.
Can I come in and make a point here?
Yes, please.
I mean, I come from Irish immigrant parents, born and brought up in Southampton, England, and then moving further north and stepping over the border in 1990 to set up the National Museum project. And one of the things that I think it's important to make mention of is, and it might seem ridiculous, Scotland and England are entirely different countries with entirely different cultures. They might share a language. Now, in terms of that attitude to, shall we say, the aristocracy and class, one of the people in looking at other sports that I particularly like is the Earl of Eglinton, who was a massive supporter of every sport you can manage, in particular curling, bowls, and archery. And when you read the comments, it's always made explicit by him, if not by others, that if you are playing something like curling, you are one of us. Do not start giving us your airs and graces. And it appears to be very much accepted in sport. And as a complete coincidence, I was looking this morning at Littleton's a biography of Littleton, and came up with this cracker where obviously Littleton is one of the old Etonians, and there's the two brothers, Edward and Alfred, and it refers in as a child, he would go out with his dad, Lord Littleton, who, as they were travelling along, quote, "he never could resist lightly flicking with a whip anyone he met or passed. The joke was not always appreciated, and the victim would sometimes descend from his cart or carriage and hurl stones after him," which is why poor old Alfred got a few stones hurled at him. And it's just extraordinary. This book is not meant to be read by ordinary people at the time, so it's okay to put that in. It's only now we look back. So always look at the upper classes in England and the upper classes in Scotland differently. Maybe because Scotland's smaller, you couldn't distance yourself as much as they could in England, which of course led, in my opinion, to the ultimate downfall of the control of football, because the country was too large and they were unable to stop the Blackburn Rovers quote, hordes of men with uncouth men in strange garb coming down and basically taking over football.
Thank you. I just want to say that some of the chat room has been most interesting. A lot of very important details and texts have been mentioned in there. I want to just thank everyone for that. Kyle Ferguson of Ulster University made a really good point. One of the things that shocked me about the miniseries was the way in which it does represent questions concerning the governance of the game and certain issues about FIFA and IFAB right now. The fact that they actually care to dramatize the game behind the game is perhaps something that could keep us talking for well beyond our allotted 90 minutes. But the referee has glanced again at his timepiece, and as such is blowing the whistle three times. So I would like to thank all of you for participating, especially our guest featured speakers, Andy Mitchell, Jed O'Brien, Martin Westby, Tony Collins, Gene Williams, David Mason, truly an all-star squad of experts on 19th century football. And for all of you that joined in, sent in comments and questions, participated in the comments, and hopefully the conversation will continue in social media. Again, if you have comments, please do use the hashtag FSF English Game. So thank you all. And Peter, do you perhaps have any concluding comments?
I'm just going to turn it over to Alex Galarza for one final announcement.
Yeah, you'll hear me over the PA announcement as you're leaving your seats, looking around, making sure you didn't lose anything. The group's purpose originally was just to bring this community of scholars together and interested parties. And I think we're living through unprecedented times, and the chat has already revealed a few different angles through which we all approach what we were talking about today through different angles of work. And I just wanted at the end here to say, whatever kinds of ideas you have on how this group can be useful in the next few months as we re-envision our classes, as we re-envision our research agendas, as we think thoughts about the game and how it relates to our work, please reach out to Peter and I. We've had a lot of success in the last few years in delegating the hosting and moderating responsibilities to people like David and Tom in this session, who did a wonderful job, so thank you. So there's a number of ways in which we can envision sessions. One that I'm particularly interested in is pedagogy. We have a lot of experience on that front, and a lot of us are dealing with that in a professional capacity right now, how to be successful on that front. And just in the emails before this session, other Fútbol Telenovelas like Club de Cuervos was mentioned. So if we want to continue on the Netflix theme or the film theme, there's other sessions we could do. So again, please just reach out to Peter and I with your ideas, volunteering to do any moderating or co-hosting, and we'll open up to the group the possibility of having a few more sessions in the months to come. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Take care of yourselves, and we'll connect again soon. Ciao.